everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 328. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Rapid7. Big thanks to Rapid7 for making this week's podcast possible. And in this week's sponsor interview, we'll be chatting with Rapid7's Chief Research Officer, HD Moore. But you know what? One interview with HD just isn't enough, is it? So he's also joining us in the feature segment to discuss a project I'm putting together called Invisible.im that I've managed to sort of rope him into somehow. Invisible.im is an instant messenger system that I designed, and it feels very, very weird saying that because I do suffer from acute imposter syndrome. But yeah, I designed an IM system for journalists and other privacy-conscious people, and HD actually took the idea and made it work. He has created a prototype, and much to everyone's surprise, it actually works. So we're on to something, and he'll be along after the news to talk about exactly what that is. Then after that, we're going to chat with HD some more in this week's sponsor interview. HD, of course, works as the Chief Research Officer for Rapid7, and his team has been doing some really interesting work on massive internet scanning. Now, that sort of thing has become pretty trendy in the last few years, but the Rapid7 team have actually really pushed this stuff towards the cutting edge, and they've also discovered some absolutely hilarious vulnerabilities out there in the process. You know, these sort of boneheaded bugs that affect millions of devices. So Rapid7's Mark Schlosser will be at Black Hat on August 6th to talk about this research, but HD will join the show today to preview it, so do stick around for that. But before we get into all of that, our double dose of HD edition, it is time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. Adam, we've seen a startling bit of news all over the interwebs this week, actually just in the last 24 hours, saying that the NSA is really keeping an eye on anyone who's interested in anonymity technologies. I mean, you know, if you believe the headlines, if you've even Googled for information about Tor, you know, subsequently they're packet capturing everything you do from that point onwards. And you know, there's a great bit too where apparently if you're a reader of Linux Journal, this is now considered an extremist forum, which, you know, is funnily enough correct in a lot of ways, but probably not in the way they intend. What are we to make of all of this? What are we to make of this news that's just that's broken?
Yeah, so this story is coming out of Germany, and it's someone's got hold of what looks like a configuration file for XKeyscore, which was originally the NSA kind of packet header metadata capture tool, which it's unclear whether it actually does full take or just headers still. But anyway, it's a config file which describes filter configuration and tagging configuration for the XKeyscore collection process, and it looks for people connecting to a number of Tor directory services, people retrieving Tor bridge lists. You know, if you're using Tor from inside a place that's filtering the public Tor entry points, then you can get a private list of bridges. And it looks like they're collecting anyone who's talking to, or they're specifically tagging in the collection anyone who's talking to, you know, various parts of Tor, the tails distribution that bundles Tor, and yeah, funnily enough, an article on Linux Journal relating to the use of Tor and tails, which has a comment in the config file describing that, as you said, as an extremist forum. So that bit's quite funny. But I do think that, you know, like from my reading of the config file, which appears to be quite, you know, it's quite an interesting, it's an interesting file from a technical point of view, because it shows how they do the filtering, how they tag things, and allows you to include like inline C++ fragments to do extra filtering, which, you know, that I wouldn't want to write the config parser for that. But I think maybe people are, you know, getting a little bit confused between, you know, tagging data that's going through or going past the monitoring point for later mining versus targeting collection. And, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't know enough about how it all works to say one way or the other, but I think I'm not sure that everyone who's writing the, you know, the articles about this completely understands what's going on.
No, I mean, it's, I've read a few articles on it, and it's, you know, they're sort of painting slightly different pictures, which is, you know, which is why I ask you for your read on it. I guess listeners can go have a look and make their own minds up. But another interesting aspect to all of this is that there's increasing speculation that this did not come from Edward Snowden. There is mounting speculation that the NSA has another leaker on their hands.
Yeah, I read that as well, and it is interesting. You know, if we have somebody else leaking, and you can absolutely see that there would be a, you know, some degree of copycatting going on. I mean, whistleblowing is obviously much more in fashion now post Snowden, but yeah, that would be an interesting development, wouldn't it? To see a non-Snowden leak source.
Well, I mean, adding a bit of credibility to that is the fact that Bruce Schneier is saying there's a, you know, it's possible it's a second leaker because, of course, he had access to the original Snowden trove of documents. So, yeah, could be a little bit of a problem over there at Fort Meade or Hawaii or wherever. And, you know, we've seen a string of NSA-related stories this week. Wired is carrying a piece saying, you know, there's been a sort of NSA report come out. They say there were 89,000 targets selected last year. But, of course, these targets in NSA lingo could that could mean a group, not just an individual. So we're none the wiser as to the actual true number of people being snooped on.
Yeah, so these numbers are coming out from a new transparency report that came out of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And, yeah, they summarize a number of areas under which the NSA has been collecting data, and one of these is these number of, you know, 89,000 targets. But, of course, as you say, like, targets can be, you know, organizations, they can be companies, they can be whole countries.
I don't know. I think the whole idea of a transparency report from an intelligence organization is just, you know, yeah, let's believe what they say.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, yeah, some of these things just don't read particularly true. And, yeah, the idea that you could lump in, you know, even if you were producing realistic numbers, the idea that these numbers could be so disproportionate to what you would actually expect. I mean, if for example, you're sniffing all of the phone calls in Bermuda, which apparently they were recording every single phone call in Bermuda, and you call that one out of your 89,000, then yeah, that's
well,
a little disingenuous.
Two.
Well, and Al-Qaeda, two.
ISIL, yes. And ISIS, three.
Three, you know, Linux Journal, four.
Exactly.
As you say, like, transparency from an organization that is absolutely about secrecy the whole time, yeah, we're like, I guess we don't have a whole bunch of faith in that process, do we?
Yeah, well, there's been this, I mean, is that a separate report to the output of this Intelligence Oversight Board, or is that quoting from the same document? Because there is another report here, a separate report, where some sort of oversight board set up in the wake of the Snowden leaks has actually more or less given the NSA a tick in a broad sense and said it's not really as bad as people are making out, which, you know, how comforted should Americans be by that? Because it's the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board.
Yeah, so this is a report that's been done by the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. So it's a separate group from the previous report, and they've considered a number of aspects of work that the NSA has been doing. And this particular bit was relating to Section 702 of the FISA Act, which is relating to them obtaining data from, you know, service providers and, you know, Google, Yahoo, essentially the PRISM bit. And they've concluded that the process by which they were doing this was essentially, you know, legal and fine, which, not exactly what you expect, is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when all of this stuff first broke, I remember you and I saying, you know, the actual PRISM part seemed to be actually a little bit overhyped. I mean, the X-Keyscore stuff and the phone metadata stuff, you know, it strikes me as being, you know, absolutely horrible. But the actual PRISM, once you delved into it, once you realised that the analyst who actually put together that PowerPoint had sort of overcooked it, it didn't seem too bad. So I can't say I'm particularly surprised to see a tick here. The Electronic Frontiers Foundation have actually said, though, in relation to this report, it is legally flawed and factually incomplete. No surprises there. It is essentially their role to say that. but certainly, you know, the 702 stuff seemed to be the part that, you know, when I looked at the broader context of the Snowden leaks, it was the part that concerned me least, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Bit of trouble, too, for the GCHQ, which is, of course, Britain's equivalent agency to the NSA. It is being sued in Europe over, presumably, the Belgicom breach. ISPs are getting together and suing them and saying, stop owning all our admins.
Yeah, so this is an interesting lawsuit filed with the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, and it basically alleges that the GCHQ violated European human rights, and in particular the British legislation relating to computer crime when they broke into Belgicom. And this lawsuit's been filed by a group of ISPs from the US and around Europe. And yeah, it's I guess backed up somewhat by, we've seen in some of the leaked documents some concern from the GCHQ about the legality of some of their techniques.
Yeah, you gotta love that. We're not sure this is legal, but whatevs.
Yeah,
it won't really be a problem unless someone leaks all these documents. You know, oh,
but no, apparently the UK Computer Misuse Act does potentially mean that some of the techniques they were using were actually computer crime in the UK. So, yeah, this is going to be interesting for them to resolve.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be expecting any GCHQ types to be led away in handcuffs anytime soon, but it's it's one to keep an eye on. Speaking of lawsuits, the EFF is suing the NSA, and this is an interesting one because some time ago we reported on the idea that, you know, the NSA finds O'Day, it uses O'Day, and they say they have a public interest test for whether or not this is, you know, these vulnerabilities should be disclosed to vendors and whether or not it's in the public interest to actually use them as tools versus, you know, patch infrastructure. The EFF says that's not good enough to just say you have a process. We want to know what that process is. So they're suing to find out.
Yeah, they filed a Freedom of Information Act request for some data about this. It's called the Vulnerabilities Equities Process that they use to assess, you know, the importance of these O'Days. And then that FOIA request was, you know, rebuffed without any particular reason. And yes, they're now following up with a lawsuit to try and get access to some
of
the information.
We're going to decline this request because if we accept it, then we have to admit embarrassing things, which is there's some guy, in, you know, sitting in a cubicle down there. We go, hey, Gus, what do you reckon we should do with this one? And he goes, I think that would probably be their process, you'd think.
Well, exactly. I mean, how are they going to give up their sweet, sweet bugs, are they? Right.
It depends on what they are. But yeah, look, it'll be really interesting to see what the outcome of that lawsuit is. And I think, you know, I've got a foot in both camps on that one. I think it's kind of reasonable when you're dealing with such a major issue of public interest to sort of at least understand what the process is. I don't see how that would be really exposing much tradecraft. But then again, I'm not a spook.
No, you wouldn't think so. But yeah, well, exactly. Maybe there's things we don't know. But yeah, it does seem like at least the process would be a thing they could tell us. You know, the criteria, that would be useful.
The new head of the NSA, Vice Admiral Michael S. Rogers, has popped up and saying some sort of interesting stuff, actually. There's a great story here on CNET where he's like, hey, you know, the sky isn't falling. Edward Snowden hasn't, you know, ruined us and stuff like that. He's sort of come out and said a bunch of reasonable stuff, whereas Keith Alexander said that it was, you know, Snowden's actions were tantamount to killing 20 people and all of that sort of alarmist stuff. You know, this new bloke seems a little bit more on the chill side. At least that's how he's coming across so far.
Yeah, well, I guess his PR people have decided that, you know, a little less hyperbole and a little more low profile might be what they're looking for these days. Mm. But yeah, well, I guess it remains to be seen exactly whether he manages to, you know, actually deliver on what I assume has been he's been told to do, which is make sure that no one leaks anything again. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, well, he actually says, am I ever going to sit here and say as the director that with 100% certainty no one can compromise our systems from the inside? Nope, because I don't believe that in the long run. And he's absolutely right. He's, you know, having him come out into the public and say some reasonable things is a, you know, good start, but we really don't know what he's like yet.
Not yet, no.
China has decided not to cooperate with the US in joint cybercrime investigations and efforts and programs. And this is, of course, because it's been attributed to the decision by the United States to charge in absentia these, or at least indict these, you know, Unit 61398 PLA dudes. So apparently, yeah, China is saying, no, we're not going to cooperate now on cybercrime. Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, and I imagine this is a pretty real problem for, you know, a lot of people working in law enforcement who are in the middle of investigations that involve, you know, people bouncing through China to hack things. I mean, you know, Lord knows no one would ever do that. So, yeah, I guess this is, well, it's not unexpected, is it? We, you know, we speculated that there would be some, you know, response from the Chinese other than bluster. And this is, you know, something that, you know, I think really does stymie, you know, real law enforcement. So, you know, put some pressure back on the US to, you know, make the next move.
Speaking of cybercrime, Microsoft has copped a bit of blowback this week. They launched a sort of stealth domain shuttering attack on a botnet, which seemed to be, you know, like a pretty well-exercised move, actually. But they went to one of these dynamic DNS services. You know, one of these CNCs was using a DNS service called noip.com, which is, you know, just your typical sort of dynamic DNS, you know, username dot one of their domain names dot whatever. And apparently they wound up shuttering something like 24 legit domains as well. Uh-oh.
Yeah, so I mean, we've seen Microsoft take some pretty proactive action against botnets in the last, you know, couple of years. Their, you know, their team that's been doing botnets takedowns have, you know, have done some really good work. And we've talked about, you know, their process and sort of, you know, we've by and large been pretty complimentary, I think, in the way that Microsoft have handled this kind of thing in the past. But it does appear that they somewhat bungled this new IP one, because they took over a bunch of the domains, and the idea was that they were going to filter the domains being used by this particular botnet, you know, sinkhole them somewhere, and then pass on the rest of the queries to the, you know, new IP and return legitimate responses. And it appears that they either misconfigured their replacement name servers, or they underestimated the amount of volume of traffic they were going to handle, and ended up, you know, breaking service for the bulk of NoIP's customers, which has left a lot of people fairly upset, including NoIP, who apparently got very little warning about the fact that this was going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, they were keeping it tight, right? They were keeping it close. And it's not an ideal situation, that's for sure. But to their credit, I mean, the latest I've heard on this is that Microsoft has said, we're working to restore service for those legit users, and have said, sorry, it was a mistake. So they're not trying to PR spin their way out of it. They're saying, yep, our bad. We made a mistake.
Yeah, and that's obviously the correct thing to do. You know, they believe that they are doing something that's in the public good, and taking out a botnet, you know, probably is. Mm. But that process is not always going to be smooth, and, you know, best that they, you know, admit that publicly as they have, and learn for next time.
Well, at least they're not blaming Canada, which is what they did. I think that was earlier this week. It could have been late last week when they sent out an email. To their, you know, everyone subscribed to their security list, saying this will be the last email security bulletin. We're not going to be doing them anymore. And everyone was like, what? And it emerged that they were blaming Canada's anti-spam laws for the cessation of their security bulletins. And I was just thinking, man, how long is it going to be before they reverse this decision? Because that's just crazy. And sure enough, they have reversed that decision, and they will resume sending emails. But God, what?
it was particularly funny, and of course the Canadians who are behind the anti-spam law were rather confused about this, because there was no particular reason that Microsoft would be in violation of the Canadian legislation. But yes, Microsoft about faced very, very quickly on that one, and will indeed now email you about security updates.
Yes, some compliance guy got a big slap in the back of the head. I'm thinking. Now, also staying with Microsoft, and they have, awesome, enabled TLS for their SMTP boxes, which is, you'd think they would have done it before now, right?
Yeah, they have been rather tardy in the uptake of TLS transport of SMTP, and that was something that Google called them out for relatively soon after the Snowden thing broke. But I mean, people have been
But Hotmail not using TLS, I mean, that just seems nuts.
Yeah, but I guess SMTP TLS hasn't really been a very widespread thing. You know, just because, the advice is always to use end-to-end crypto if you care, and, relying on mail service to do TLS transport for mail.
I guess that was before we knew the NSA was sucking everything through fiber taps into a huge data center in Utah,
Clearly, in the post-Snowden world, having TLS transport mail is a no-brainer, and, good on Microsoft for finally pulling it together.
They've also turned on perfect forward secrecy for their OneDrive, which I guess is their, online Dropbox, Google Drive, sort of whatever competitor. So there you go. Apple has launched two-factor authentication for iCloud, about bloody time, but that's...
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good thing. Oh, here's a really interesting story that Reuters broke. Goldman Sachs, and, I hate Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs, the vampire octopus of the finance world, just, pretty much an evil organization, but I'm kind of almost on their side with this one. One of their employees accidentally sent an email to Gmail instead of an internal email address, and it contained some sensitive information. And they're now going to the courts in the US asking Google to actually delete that email from the inbox that it was inadvertently sent to, which is interesting, because you kind of think, well, that would be helpful to them. The stranger that they emailed it to has no real purpose for that information. It was sent to them in error. Do you think it's reasonable that they're asking a service provider to just sort of dip into someone's email and remove this data from it?
Well, I mean, I think, you'd like to think that Google have some sort of process for doing that. And of course, the fact they've asked for a warrant suggests that they do. And I think that probably is a reasonable thing. I mean, you can kind of see, they shouldn't have been emailing large amounts of sensitive data around anyway without end-to-end crypto and without some kind of, protection, even to internal email addresses. But,
obviously just fat-fingered it, It was just, oops.
Auto-complete.
Exactly.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I don't know. It's hard to have sympathy for Goldman Sachs, I'm afraid.
It is. But what if this was protectthepanda.org,
Yeah, then maybe we feel a little more sympathy, but I don't know. We still don't know who actually got this. I mean, no one's come forward and said, actually, yes, I was the recipient at Gmail. So if you've got any listeners, if you have a Gmail account, go and check and see if you've got an email from Goldman Sachs. It might be worth having a look at if you
and
do.
And if it contains evil corporate secrets, please do expose them because that would be good. Because,
do you think they have any non-evil secrets?
I don't know. Yeah, probably not, hey?
Anyway, I bet they want that big old internet, email recall button right about now. And tough, it doesn't exist.
Now, this one's made the news in a big way. Cisco's VRT team, which I think is, the old SourceFire VRT team, found a, malware group operating since around 2007. Interestingly enough, this malware, they ran it through about 50 different AV engines and only one picked it. So they've been stealthy since about 2007, hosting malware on Dropbox. It's a middle of the road, sort of interesting enough malware ring, but at the same time, it's getting a disproportionate amount of PR. I mean, is there something in this that I'm missing, or is their PR just really good?
I think it may just be a case of their PR being really good. I mean, the description of the techniques and the MO are, not particularly unusual. They're what you'd expect for, a competent, quite well targeted, malware threat actor. I mean, they're doing targeted phishing. They're dropping, undetectable remote access trojans, stealing some data and doing that, in a way that has relatively good OPSEC. I mean, that's hopefully what everybody's doing these days, right? They're not complete rubbish. But no, there doesn't appear to be anything that really stands out other than the fact that it's, relatively long-lasting and clearly relatively targeted, although we don't actually know towards what.
Yeah. Now, Symantec also has a report out advising that there has been a group of attackers presumed to be based in Eastern Europe who have been attacking the energy companies, actually. So I'll drop a link to that in this week's show notes. It's known as either Dragonfly or Energetic Bear, which is, I don't know where they get this stuff from. But so if you are in the energy sector, you might want to check that one out. Now, there is an interesting bit of malware. We don't normally spend a lot of time discussing malware, but this Crydex variant called Geodo, it's actually really cool because it pulls down a pre-put together list of stolen SMTP credentials and uses that to propagate. So it's part Trojan, but it's got a proper old school worm infection vector. It's kind of cool, right? It's kind of old school.
Yeah. It's retro these days, isn't it? Mm. Doing large scale spam based email propagation of malware. Of course, the fact they're using authenticated SMTP improves the delivery rates, and I presume that they're stealing the credentials with the botnet and then feeding those back into the SMTP propagation system because the worm appears to pull down the list of credentials, on the fly.
Like you get infected and then you get 50,000 creds and off you go.
Yeah, which, I mean, that's almost worth getting infected just to get, a useful list of credentials. But, it's quite a cool...
You would say that.
Well, I mean, isn't that what everyone would do?
But, yeah, that one is actually worth a look. Krebs has a great story here about this. There's, a wire transfer service that operates in Brazil called Boleto. Apparently there's just rampant fraud occurring there. And, he's saying that the attackers may have actually netted the equivalent of billions of dollars in the past 2 years. I mean, wow, billions.
Yeah, that's it's a pretty big story. I mean, this is a funds transfer system that is sort of specific to Brazil, and it sounds like there are some crime groups operating in Brazil that are doing fairly standard man in the browser, transaction hijacking techniques. But they're doing this on a very, very widely used form of payment in Brazil. I mean, it's as I understand it, I'd never heard of it before, not being from Brazil, but as I understand it, is more widely used than credit cards in Brazil because a lot of people don't have credit cards, a lot of people don't have bank accounts. And it's used for paying, bills and government services and, buying things retail. It's just, the dominant form of ad hoc funds transfer in Brazil. And so, yeah, the fact that it could be up to billions of dollars is pretty incredible. And that's RSA has been running a report saying something up to maybe $3.75 billion.
Yeah, which is, pretty good payday for all those guys involved. Go you.
Yeah, I mean, Krebs has some screenshots of the various some of the control panels for this malware. Mm. So if you want to see what it looks like to go steal $1 billion, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, it looks like they could actually, if they were making that much, they could probably have invested in a little bit more design. But anyway,
some prettier CSS, perhaps.
That's it. Now, look, apparently, big arrest. big charges. The dude who apparently hacked the Burger King Twitter account 17 months ago has been busted. But this guy's been previously convicted for doing other stuff, for like accessing millions of records sent by Twitter users requesting technical support. How on earth would you come across that sort of information? I mean, sure, the headline's cool because it's like, okay, this is the guy who hacked Burger King's Twitter account. We all remember when that happened. But it seems like this person may have been up to all sorts of stuff. His name is Cameron LaCroix. He's a 25-year-old resident of New Bedford, Massachusetts. So interesting.
Yeah, some other reports are suggesting that he was one of the people who stole Paris Hilton's nudes from her phone back in like 2005. So like clearly he's got some skills on the internet, but yeah, maybe the Burger King Twitter account was a hack too far.
Yeah, so apparently he exploited a website vulnerability to create Zendesk accounts with elevated privileges, and then he disabled security measures designed to ensure that only Twitter employees could view Twitter help desk information. So he kind of owned them through their help desk software, which is, yeah, good job.
Well, he's going down now, so
yeah, sure is. Sucks to be him. And with form too, they don't like it when you go back to court for doing the same stuff that they've already convicted you for. So have fun in prison, guy Cameron LaCroix. FireEye has found an Android remote access Trojan, which is kind of interesting. Apple has patched a whole bunch of bugs in Mavericks, iOS and Safari. Cisco's patched another hard-coded SSH key vulnerability in UCM. What the hell, guys? How many of these have we seen?
Well, yeah, that's a very fair thing to say, because this is it's just not good enough. This is in the Cisco Unified Communications Manager, which is, of course, like the middle of your phone system. And if someone has SSH access to that, then whoopoo, they've got, root in the middle of your phone network. That's bad. You'd really hope that Cisco would have picked this one up a little bit
earlier.
But
is that like fully just like a hard-coded key? If you've, you've got one of those appliances, you just pull out the standard hard-coded key, put it in your own SSH client, and then bang, you're in.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, which is just depressing for a system that, runs your entire company's phones.
Yeah. Right.
Bad Cisco.
PHP has fixed OpenSSL flaws in new releases, so go update to your PHP modules. And Google has patched a shared links vulnerability in Google Drive, which I guess is great news for all people using those services. Links in this week's show notes. And Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Oh, cheers, Pat. We'll talk then.
Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's news headlines. It is time for this week's feature interview now, and we're doing something a little bit different this week. This week's episode of the show is brought to you by Rapid7, and we're lucky enough to have HD Moore in the sponsor slot. But hey, more HD Moore is better, right? So we're going to have him in the feature slot as well. And the first thing we're chatting to HD about today is a project I kicked off called Invisible.im. Now, I don't want to call it an open source project at this point, because that would be an epic overstatement. It's a concept with a working prototype that's held together pretty much with glue and duct tape. But it does work. The concept is sound. So what is it? Well, last year, you may have caught an interview I did with The Gruck, where we spoke about anonymous messaging. There are a couple of attempts out there at true anonymous IM, like TorChat and I2P Messenger. But there's no major project that adheres to standards and has a good backing. The current version of TorChat, for example, is written in Pascal. I tried downloading the OS X port, and it just didn't work for me at all. I2P Messenger is a similar type of idea over I2P, not Tor. And the guy who kicked off that project appears to have just disappeared into the ether, at least for a couple of years. So, Tor itself is kicking off an instant messenger bundle, but all that does is glue an XMPP client like, Pigeon or whatever. It glues that to Tor, so you're obscuring your originating IP to an established third-party service. But what we wanted to do is create something more like TorChat or I2P Messenger, which doesn't rely on a third-party service at all, like the Tor messaging bundle will. We hope that this can eventually be spun into something that's well-maintained. So what we want to do is create an instant messenger client that doesn't leak buddy lists, so that they can't be scooped up by the Five Eyes intelligence services. And we know this is something they do. We want IM that doesn't leave behind logs of who spoke to who and when. You can use OTR encryption over existing instant messenger software. But, as a journalist, if I write a story based on a government leak, the first thing an investigator is going to do is pull a history of who I've spoken to via email, and they're going to pull my IM logs. So even if that Those conversations have been encrypted. There is a forensic trail there. They don't need to know what was said, merely that contact occurred. And that's the problem we're trying to solve with Invisible IM. We want to make retrospective identification of sources very, very difficult, if not impossible. Now, writing a client from scratch to pump messages out over Tor hidden services, shunting them over Tor, that's just too much work. But I had a minor brainwave a couple of weeks back. When you run a Tor hidden service, you're routable from everywhere, right? So you have a static, reachable identifier, much like a static real-world IP, and it's, you know, cryptographically verified. So why would you need a third-party service, like an XMPP service? All of the plumbing is actually already there. So I thought, what if you get yourself an XMPP server, run it on localhost, get an XMPP client, point it at your local XMPP service, and then get the server component to federate on the fly with other XMPP servers over Tor hidden services. So bang, there's no need at all for third-party infrastructure. I'm running an SMPP server. We've chosen Prosody. You are as well. And, because your Tor hidden service address is your ID, I just go, username at bang, your Tor hidden service address, and it just automatically federates. So I was chatting with HD a few weeks ago about this and mentioned this idea to him. And, he's the kind of guy that once he wonders, hey, could that work? He has to just go and try it. So 6 hours later, we actually had a working prototype. And much to our shock, it actually works. Like status notifications, OTR, like everything just worked. So now we want to turn this thing into an actual proper living project. Even if a competent open source organization wants to take this from us, we would love that as well. The main thing that we're concerned with, that I'm concerned with, is that this gets done and it becomes something out there that people can use. We need to free up communication between ordinary people and leakers and the media, because that's what you need in a functioning democracy. So I've published a lengthy FAQ at the website invisible.im that you can read, and that explains it better than this rambling mess that I'm doing now. But the basic idea is you can have an IM client that is tied to a Tor hidden service. And as a journalist, you can publish this hidden service address on, say, your Twitter bio, along with your OTR key fingerprint. And from there, people can contact you with a verified identity or with a transient identity. They can spill the beans, drop documents on you, and the authorities have little hope of retrospectively figuring out even that a conversation occurred. So yeah, I have been ranting a bit here, but I thought it would make sense to get HD on the line via Skype and ask him also to try to explain what the hell we're doing. So HD, what the hell are we doing?
We're trying to fix the thing that everyone else seems to screw up. The current population, the current market for this stuff, you tend to have it split by mobile and non-mobile today. So for example, you've got Wet Web and you've got Tech Secure and those folks on the mobile side, really focusing just on mobile users. Then you have the entire desktop clients, things like Tor Chat, etc. Well, the approach so far is everyone always wants to own the entire stack. If you look at the way that Tech Secure works, for example, it's federated, but there's only two servers. There's the one run by Moxie's company and the one run by the CyanogenMon company. If you look at the way that WhatsApp is implemented, it's all going to one company. You're looking at a centralized model for communication, and there are people, like the BitTorrent project, for example, doing a bit chat that's distributed and broadcast based and so on. But the problem is running software is hard. It's really easy to write bad software, especially when you're trying to write software that covers every possible layer of every possible stack and protects anonymity as well as reliability as well as identification. So, the thing that we've been working on is really saying, well, who's the best point solution for each of these tools today that's open source? Which of these programs can we actually audit? Can we authenticate? And then can we actually connect these things together in a way that they deliver a secure solution that's going to be maintained 10 years from now, because each of these projects will still be maintained going forward.
Tor's solution seems to be to use a Tor client to anonymize access to existing XMPP and, like Jabber services and Yahoo and whatnot, which seems to me kind of pointless, right? Because if you're still using a username that is registered with a service, you're still leaving behind a metadata trail.
Well, absolutely. It's still centralized. Whoever's controlling the centralized point can start doing things like metadata collection, can figure out traffic patterns, things like that. You want to get away from that mode.
TorChat has already done this, right? And this is what DPR used in his communications about Silk Road. It's a desktop client. It works pretty well. But the first version was written in Python. Second version is written in Pascal. It's a little bit weird. You know what I mean? So it was sort like, let's do a proper one here. And instead of writing it from the ground up, it seemed kind of like a wacky idea, but you could use existing software like an XMPP server, but instead of connecting to it on a remote computer, you could actually connect to it on localhost and then use Tor Hidden Services to handle the plumbing and then just get it to federate. Instead of federating two servers federating, you've got basically endpoints federating towards each other. I came to you and said, do you think that'll work? And you actually managed to belt out a prototype in what, 6 hours?
Something like that. I mean, there's challenges with it. The Tor folks believe that if every single user in the network ran a hidden service, things wouldn't work very well. And obviously, if you run a hidden service and a relay or a hidden service and an exit node, it's pretty easy to find out who you are just by a process of elimination of targeting each node until you basically the communication stops with the hidden service you're targeting. However, you're not going to have that many users. The biggest challenge we have today is usability. How do you provide something that's safe, that someone can easily, you know, either really run in three different modes, either as a journalist, you want to publish your secure ID that someone can always connect to you under, either coming from an anonymous handle or one you vetted before, or you want to be an anonymous leaker and be able to provide information to somebody who is a trusted signed identity that you know about that you can just punch into your, you know, very easy to use, very friendly instant messenger client. Or you want to have a long-term encrypted communication and encrypted identity you can then use going forward. And I think, you know, each of those each of those challenges can be solved with the solution that we're looking at. And each of those is much harder to do with existing products that are out there.
Yeah. So the idea would be, it's kind of a fiddly concept, but I think it can be reasonably explained when, you've got basically a Tor hidden service address and that becomes your IAM ID. And this is something that you can list on your Twitter page along with your OTR key fingerprints, because one of the things that we are doing with this is mandating the use of OTR, because it is extremely easy to impersonate someone else under the model that we've put forward. But OTR kind of gets you around that. But, you know, if you do wind up using this, you really want to check OTR, right?
That's true. I mean, the great thing about the way Tor hidden services are implemented is when Tor first starts up, it generates an RSA key. So there's actually a lot of really good opportunities to take the hidden key generated by Tor, turn that into a PGP key ID, turn that into an SSH key ID, turn that into an SSL cert. You can end up basically using one key to validate your identity across multiple services, multiple federations, multiple clients, multiple protocol layers on top of that. And you have a single identity that you can then throw away if you want to use it temporarily or hold on to it for the long term. Mm-hmm. So I feel like because Tor is really based on the concept of every user running a hidden service has a secret RSA key that they then use to sign and create their public identifier. And so many other services are built on RSA as well. We really can get to a position where that single Tor generated hidden service key becomes your global identity for a lot more services than just this chat.
One key to rule them all.
And easy to dispose of. Delete the file, overwrite it, and there's no proof that it was ever you, ever, anywhere.
So yeah, I guess the idea with this thing is to have an IAM client where no one can retrospectively figure out if a conversation occurred or with who. And, you know, it looks like by gluing together, you know, Pigeon, basically, to a locally hosted XMPP server, and then kind of duct taping it to Tor, it kind of works. Did it surprise you that it was this easy to put it all together?
At first, I kind of blew it off saying, there's no way in hell this is going to work. These products just aren't going to work well together. The more work I spent prototyping it, testing it, it actually was pretty solid. And then we started looking at, how do other projects work? How do other successful projects work for anonymity? If you look at the Tor browser bundle, that is by far the most commonly used, you know, service today to browse internet anonymously. And the reason that it works is because instead of Tor having to go develop their own custom web browser every single time, they take the best of the breed components that are open source, Firefox, et cetera, glue it all together, mash into a nice little configuration script and let it go. Granted, there's problems with that, which means basically intelligent services will target just the versions you ship, but at least it's open source, at least you can harden it, at least you have an upstream that's continuing to give you updates and quality software. The scope of what we're trying to accomplish is too big for any one software vendor to do it right, and we really have to look at best of breed and combining those solutions to really have a solution that's going to have long-term legs.
Now, I know you reached out to some people involved in the sort of Tor community and said, hey, we're doing this with hidden services. And their response is, oh, God, please no. Because, you know, as we've sort of found out through this process, hidden services are a little bit on the fragile side. And they weren't designed to be handed out as readily as IAM IDs. You know, they were sort of designed for things more along the lines of Silk Road, I guess. That's a pretty good use case for a Tor hidden service. HD, are we going to break Tor?
Maybe, but Tor's job is to make Tor work regardless. I mean, Tor got hit by a botnet that added some ridiculous number of nodes to their system in a very short period of time. They were able to survive and adapt and move forward. If we get to a model where, you know, it's 10% or even 5% or some large portion of the Tor population is actually running hidden services, they're going to adapt the code. They're going to find a way to make it work more efficiently. There's ways to get there, but the pressure isn't on them to solve those problems yet until it becomes a problem. I mean, it's a great problem to have, basically.
Yeah.
And the biggest challenge is that nodes that run hidden services are at risk if they offer relay services or bridges or exits. And that means that effectively anybody who would use this software in the most secure fashion would effectively be a leech on the Tor network, which isn't great. And it'd be nice if there's ways for folks who are part of this to become, you know, better, better participants within the Tor community and drive some more value with their involvement. But that's something that the Tor folks have to figure out how to solve.
Well, and that's one thing that we can look at as well. Like if you wind up going into some sort of idle mode, maybe it can spin up a Tor node at some point, like a relay node. And then maybe when you're chatting, it sort of kills that, or, you know, we got to think more about this, and we're very eager to hear from people within the Tor community about ways that we can actually be part of the solution and not just part of some new horrible problem that makes them hate us. So where are we at, HD, and why don't we tell people where we're at and what we actually need in order to get this thing to work properly?
So right now we've got a shell script you can run in Ubuntu that'll go ahead and grab Prosody, it'll grab Pigeon, it'll grab Tor, it will, you know, glue them all together in the right way, auto-configure IDs, configure accounts, lock things down pretty securely, and then pop up Pigeon. And magically, you can start typing in someone else's magic onion ID and start having a conversation with OTR right then, right there without any additional work. So we have that working just fine on Ubuntu. It uses existing off-the-shelf packaging tools components. Obviously, there's no front end to it. It's kind of ugly. You have to kind of know what you're doing to really maintain it. On the Windows side, we've got a batch script that basically does the same thing. It glues together the three latest releases of all those pieces of software, including some custom scripts and bindings in between for scripting. And essentially, we'll launch a Pigeon client that's auto-configured to only go through Tor and only talk to hidden service IDs. So, you know, what we'd like to do long-term, of course, is be able to put a front end on this thing, have it work for Mac OS X, have it basically configurable to work in one of those three different modes we talked about, either as a long-term recipient of data, as an anonymous submitter, that's kind of a one-time throwaway identity, or somebody who wants to have a long-term kind of pseudo-anonymous identity that they can use to communicate with people over this protocol.
So what skills do we need?
Obviously, we need someone who can do, you know, Windows development, Windows front-end development, even better if they can do cross-platform development, because we need a front-end that's consistent. A good example of this would be the Vidalia client for the Tor browser bundle. Essentially, it's just a pop-up form that asks you to fill in some options, you know, declare your preferences, and then all it does on the back end is configures the software according to what you decided you wanted to do. There is one caveat that we should talk about, and that is this will never protect you if both parties are being watched at the same time. And the reason behind that is nothing can when it comes down to it. The challenge is that if, you know, the case I'd like to reference is Jeremy Hammond, the way they ended up busting him when he was using Tor was that when he left his house, they watched his client stop talking on an IRC channel. When he went back to his house, they started seeing him chat again. So as long as someone has the ability to watch your conversations on both ends at the same time, or they say, hey, there's a power outage in the city, and all of a sudden this person dropped offline. Those are the kinds of things that, unless you start injecting kind of chaff into the stream and, you know, setting up more relays and fake background traffic, which, you know, would be destructive to Tor in terms of bandwidth capabilities, you just can't solve. So we knew that going into it that we can't make a perfect solution, but we do think that it would be really tough for someone to determine who talked to who after the fact, especially with one-use throwaway identities.
Yeah, so I mean, the idea being that if you've got some documents, you know, you can spin up this software, you know, you could even, well, eventually it'd be nice to have a bootable USB, spin it up, plug in the detail of the journalist or whistleblowing organization that you want to give this information to, send it, you know, have a bit of a chat, set up a transfer, and eventually, you know, I've been talking with Micah Lee about maybe, you know, getting Onion Share or something like it to work as an actual file transfer tool. So that we can start moving files around as well, because that's one thing that won't work through the XMPP sort of federation model. It tries to set up a third-party transfer, and that's all horrible. Yeah, so that's the use case, is that someone can actually just spin it up, drop the documents they need, have a conversation with someone, and then they could just effectively disappear. And anyone retrospectively trying to figure out if that contact occurred is just going to hit a brick wall. There's going to be no XMPP logs. There's going to be no email logs. There's going to be zero trail. That's the idea. So I guess if people want to get in touch, what, info@invisible.im?
Yep, that's the best solution. And again, if you do front-end development, whether it's cross-platform or specifically to Mac, Windows, Linux, let us know. If you want to get involved on the server side, if you know how to write code for the Prosty backend, if you want to help with, you know, that's basically all Lua language. If you want to help with Pigeon modules to make this much easier. If you want to help us do things like build a web of trust using a single RSA key, if you will, to rule them all, in terms of gluing together your OTR with your Tor, with your GPG, with your SSL, and so on. Those are all things we could use help with. And, if, you know, of course, folks who want to maintain this long term. If this is something that you're passionate about, that you've got a long-term need for, and you're willing to put in resources, whether that's development time, you know, funding an organization that maintains it. Those are all folks we want to hear from.
And of course, you know, in the long term, this is, of course, you know, very not even beta yet. This is like proof of concept stage. So later on down the track, the idea, of course, would be to remove as much cruft as we can from all of the bits and pieces that we're using, you know, and really look at trying to lock it down so that your chances of getting owned through some sort of, you know, XMPP bug are greatly reduced. But of course, you know, we've got to build it before we try to break it. So that's what we're trying to have help with. And of course, you know, the idea also is that we can improve some of these bits of software that we're using, right?
Absolutely. And if you look at the way that the Tor Browser Bundle project approached Mozilla ended up getting some benefit out of it as well. So we'd love to be able to contribute back to Tor, contribute back to Pigeon, contribute back to Prosody, and really let them benefit from the fact that we're using their components to build this.
Okay, HD, you're going to stay on the line now because you're hanging around for our sponsor segment.
It's kind of odd being in their shoes, but yep.
Weird or not, please do stick around. But yeah, in the meantime, anyone who wants some more info can head to invisible.im there. And the FAQ is up there already. And yeah, if you want to get involved, do email info@invisible.im. And we would like to get this thing working over I2P too. We don't want to just limit it to Tor. So if that's your specialty, get in touch. And yeah, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this week's episode is brought to you by Rapid7, makers of fine, fine information security software. Rapid7 makes Metasploit-based products, seam gear, vuln scanners, all sorts of stuff. Do check them out at rapid7.com. HD is, of course, Rapid7's chief research officer, and he has an interest in massive scanning. It's been something he's been working on and presenting on for a couple of years, and these days his colleagues at Rapid7 are also involved in massive scanning. HD's colleague Mark Schlosser is due to present Rapid7's latest research in this area at Black Hat in Las Vegas on August 6th. But, you know, as we've got HD on the line with us right now, we're going to ask him for a bit of a preview. So, HD, why don't you start by giving us a bit of history on your involvement in, you know, scanning everything on the net? Why did you start doing it?
I mean, for me personally, the concept of the internet being this big amorphous entity that you can kind of go explore is how I got into security, how I got into phreaking, how I got into word dialing. Everything is really came from the desire to explore and kind of understand what's out there. My first attempt with that, at least at a larger scale, was a critical.io project back in 2012. That resulted in all sorts of law enforcement interest, complaints, abuse mail. You know, did a lot of things wrong, found out how to do a lot of things better. Over the, succeeding 2 years, we basically see the tools increase. We've seen Robert Graham's MastCan tool. We've seen Zakir and J. Alex Halderman's ZMAP team and ZMAP product come together. And, you know, Shodan itself has been kind of the barnstorming area and really the first people out the gate to take the risk of displaying this data and making it accessible to the public and really showing people how bad it is. The great thing about having services like Shodan and having this data available is if you're trying to quantify the risk, for example, there's a new vulnerability and you say, okay, you know, do I care about this or not? Is this something we should fix or not? You can quickly see, yeah, it's a big risk if you're in Asia or if you're in Georgia or if you happen to be in this one city in Vienna or, you know, this one city in Austria, for example. Seeing the geographic distributions of vulnerabilities is really interesting.
Well, this is one thing that you actually mentioned before we started this this chat was that, you know, there's a certain type of router in Germany. There's sort of monocultures in different bits of the world where if you found a bug in this type of router, you would own one in 12 Germans.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anybody with a broadband ISP account can tell you that, you know, when your installer shows up, they bring you the crappiest possible product you've ever seen, and they force you to use it unless you go out of your way to avoid it. And everyone hates those products. They're tough to configure. They've got backdoors installed by the ISP themselves. They're typically not updated very often. And to
the
be frank,
state tables fill up when you reload, like, you know, the 15 tabs you closed before reboot.
Yeah, no kidding. And the ISP has no motivation to replace them or make them better until enough of their subscribers complain. If you look at the U.S. customer satisfaction surveys, broadband providers are on the lowest tier of customer satisfaction. A lot of that comes down to just how broken these devices are, who makes them, how cheap they are, and how slowly they get updated.
And when you've got major telcos controlling significant chunks of the market in individual countries, then, I mean, that just really elevates the risk, doesn't it? Because, as you say, one bug and an awful lot of return.
Absolutely. If you start looking at, I mean, there's a great example from a few years ago. I think I mentioned once in your program where you could change the DNS settings for a router remotely, which doesn't sound like that big of a deal. However, something like 200,000 routers in Brazil had their DNS servers changed to point to a malware site. So any website they went to served up malware. So just a small change of being able to change some of the DNS settings remotely was enough for them to basically compromise, 100,000 plus people.
Well, you can also SSL strip their online banking sessions, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of vectors you have. I mean, the problem with routers is to control your entire internet connection goes through them. If someone has root access to it or rogue firmware, they can install a bot on it. They really own your connection. They can see all your traffic.
Now, you've been kind enough to give me a bit of a preview of the research that's going to be presented at Black Hat. And I understand that, of course, you guys, Mark, and yourself are going to want to save a lot of that for the actual presentation. But there is one finding that I'd really like to discuss, which is this NatPMP stuff. This is just, can we talk about that?
Sure.
This is the most crackheaded thing I've ever seen. Please tell us about, it's called the Network Address Translation Port Mapping Protocol. And some of the implementations are sort of so craptacular that you don't know whether to laugh or cry.
It's pretty much
well, laugh. There you go. You laughed. So I'm crying. I'll cry. You laugh.
So UPnP, for example, it was a protocol designed for network discovery, but also for mapping holes in your firewall so that you can have inbound connections to devices behind a NAT gateway. NatPMP was basically Apple's response to that, so that if you're using Airport Express or another Apple-provided device, along with a lot of other vendors these days, they decided that instead of using SOAP over UDP over another HTTP control channel and all the other stuff that's wrong with UPnP, they made a simple UDP service. And all it says is, if you send me a request from your internal IP address saying that I want this port open and I want I want this external port open and I want to go to my internal port in this port, it'll say, okay, great. And it trusts you because it saw the internal IP address from inside your network going to its service. And that's how it controls access.
Okay, and we're getting to the punchline.
Unfortunately, we found that at least 1 million of these devices will accept the same request from outside the network. And what we found during our UPnP research is something like 85% of all home networks share one of three Class Cs. It's 192.168, 0.0, 1.0/0, or 254/0. Something like 80% plus networks use those ranges, depending on what gear you have. So essentially, all you have to do is spoof a packet from the internet from those internal RFC 1918 IPs for like an important port, say 445 or 22 or something
SMB,
else. Basically to spray UDP packets spoofed to the external router, and in return it'll open up holes to your internal network on very sensitive ports.
Yeah, and you get port forwarding straight through from spoofing one UDP packet. This is the most, I mean, I, you know, palm face, like, really.
I mean, the good news is it's only 1 million. We know there's more than 1 million devices out there that support NatPMP. So obviously, there's only one or two vendors that really screw this up. We haven't done the research yet to figure out what those vendors are. Just like SIP, we realized that with the SIP protocol, there's 16 million devices out there that expose SIP to the internet, SIP being the voice over IP signaling protocol, the thing that lets you make phone calls inbound, to ring, hang up, call, et cetera, and negotiate the media ports. We found that of those 16 million odd SIP exposed devices, almost 7 million of them were just in Germany and all running the exact same software. And the funny thing about that is normally that means that one ISP has shipped the same basically hardware to every one of their customers. What we found instead is that every ISP in Germany is shipping the exact same hardware, just different versions of it, all basically rebranded versions of AVM's speed ports or Fritz boxes, which use a very similar SIP stack and SIP code base. So anytime you find a monoculture, especially in software land, especially when it affects a large portion of a population, those can turn into really bad scenes really quick.
So where did we get the 1 in 12 number when it comes to Germany? Because it sounds like from what you just told me, it could be an awful lot more than that.
Well, that's the thing. We thought it'd be interesting to apply some weighting based on population. So if you look at in the top three countries with exposure, you have Germany, Japan, and Spain, and then the U.S. is some tiny, tiny sliver of that. If you look at it weighted by population, though, Germany is something like, I want to say 60-something percent of the exposure of, you know, in other words, 1 in 12 of every Germans has at least has a device with exposed support on the internet, probably running software from AVM, which develops the Fritzbox and the SIP software itself. So, of course, we're still digging into what the vulnerabilities are, what the exposure is, but just from our history, knowing that a single software stack is being used by a large population generally means that there's, you know, 7 million possible root shells waiting out there.
Maybe you should add this to Wikipedia and the CIA World Factbook, you know, population, land mass, proportion of vulnerable hosts, you know.
Root shells per grandpa.
Yeah, exactly right. Could be an interesting way of adding some stats. What are some other key findings that you guys will be presenting next month?
We saw the same thing with the Japan. We found the same thing. Most of the ISPs there were using one model of a router with SIP exposed. Spain, same thing. Orange with their LiveBlock DSL routers had the same problem. If you go outside of SIPs or looking into some other protocols, we realized something like 25,000 machines in the internet were still running versions of Microsoft SQL Server 2000.
Yeah, that's probably not going to go so well for them, right?
I mean, this is the reason why the slammer worm came out in the first place. And there's still 25,000 boxes out there just constantly hammering the crap out of each other. And part of that was the way that a lot of software components installed the Microsoft Server Desktop Environment Edition.
Yeah.
Desktop Edition.
Yeah, so it'd be just like a default install for some bit of software that probably doesn't even need SQL 2000.
But it was still amazing to see that, you know, that number of devices still exposed out there. And we saw something like 42,000 devices running Microsoft SQL Server 2005.
Man, there's still like SadMind and stuff out there, you know, like you plug in a, maybe not SadMind, but you'd see Code Red still floating around. You plug in a, you know, you just plug something into the internet and just start, you know, run a PCAP. I mean, you're going to see all sorts of shit that should have died years ago.
No kidding. Some worms last forever. I mean, you still see Blaster, you still see Conficker. The stuff never goes away. There's at least one idiot out there somewhere exposing a box to the internet that's just keeping that thing propagating. And the funny thing is, if you go back to 2000 or so, you know, worms were all the rage because people actually realized how bad things were. You know, worms were the original internet-wide scanners, if you want to call them that, because they identified where all the risk was. Unfortunately, the attackers said, why bother with worms? Why bother being noisy about it? Let's go out there very specific targets instead. And so the public's awareness of how bad things have gone has gone downhill since the level, number of worms has gone downhill.
Yeah, well, I'm still waiting for an Android worm. That's got to happen eventually, right?
Well, there was that great one in Australia where the guy actually got away with it, where it was within one of the Aussie telecom networks. The guy had a brute force grip that would secure shell to all the other IPs inside the carrier NAT 10X IP space, looking for iPhones that were jailbroken running secure shell with the default password of root alpine.
Yeah, no, that was we had him on the show that week. He's he Rickrolled everyone, right? He was just using default creds for jailbroken iPhones, and he changed their wallpaper, I think, to a picture of Rick Astley.
I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, if you look at what we're scanning for internet-wide vulnerability scans that we're doing today, we're not seeing that much of the network. I mean, Asia has already run out of IPs. South America is running out of IPs. Carrier NAT is becoming the norm, especially for a lot of major ISPs in China. So the picture that we're seeing right now of IPv4 is horrible, but it's only, you know, probably 80%, if that, of the total number of devices out there. Once you get behind the carrier nets of, you know, the big Chinese ISPs like Unicom, things get a lot worse, a lot quicker. So, we're seeing kind of the internet becoming these isolated islands due to the fact that IPv4 shortages are affecting the ability to allocate IPs to all their customers.
But see, IPv6 makes this even worse, right? Because everything's routable all of a sudden, and, you know, that just makes it, I mean, yeah, it makes scanning more difficult, but it makes, you know, once you actually have an address to go after, you know, you're going to get there. You're going to route to it.
Yep, you got it. I mean, we're getting to the position now. I mean, a lot of folks like to talk about the Internet of Things and all the security problems with embedded devices. But when it comes down to it, the Internet of Things exposures aren't going to be your home DSL modem. They're going to be the central service where all your devices connect into. They'll be the Logitech service that your webcams send their data to. They're going to be the, you know, the NAS central configuration server. We saw Cisco launch a cloud-based configuration service that was mandatory for one of their routers. So that the only way to really configure your home router was to go to the Cisco managed portal at the time. This is part of them selling off the Linksys division. But I mean, that's really what we're seeing. We're seeing a centralization of management for most of these Internet of Things and embedded devices, which is really just putting more eggs in fewer baskets, but making it much harder for other people to assess how secure those baskets are.
Now, it's obviously, you know, you're scanning around for vulnerable devices that are quite common, consumer-grade devices. They stick out like sore thumbs. When it comes to enterprise, things are a little bit more fragmented and things don't quite stick out as much. But I imagine you would have, through this scanning activity and the research that you and your team have done at Rapid7, you would have found there would be some findings that would be of concern to business and government. What would they be?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the ones that we really dug into a while back was when F5 accidentally shipped a secure shell authentication key on their appliance. Essentially, there was a coprocessor on the same system and they communicated using the secure shell, but it had a hard-coded private key. So all it took was taking a Checkpoint virtual machine image and one of their ISOs, basically extracting the private key from that and then shelling it as root to a whole bunch of F5 big IP systems on the internet.
And I remember when that happened, actually. That was pretty...
Yeah, funny. I mean, that was a pretty serious issue for a lot of major... You know, basically, if you can afford one of these things, you're a serious player in whatever market you're in, or you're a government agency. And these things terminate SSL connections. So, of course, that's where all your traffic goes from being encrypted to decrypted. It's the best place possible for an attacker to capture your customer's data. The scary thing about that is, as we were scanning for it, we basically scanned it. I think we identified something like 65,000 or 70,000 the first week. The number eventually dropped down and it got fairly manageable. But on some of the systems, what we found out is that the customer didn't patch it. Someone else was rooting these boxes, backdooring them, and then patching them in the process.
What sort of numbers are we talking about? Because that's terrifying.
I'm not sure offhand. I want to say there's at least 300 or 400 that we can identify that at the customer, after we contacted them directly, said, no, we haven't been in touch. This is the first time we've heard of it. No, we didn't apply the patch. Neither has our admin. And so we know there's cases where they're, you know, basically there were people out there taking advantage of these systems and they probably still have access for all we know. So it's really difficult to assess what the impact of a lot of these issues are.
Were they specific to one sort of industry vertical? Was it in banking, insurance, or, you know, I mean, was there one type of organization that tended to be targeted more than the other?
Honestly, it was less related to industry, more related to size. So I would say it was your Fortune 500s were much more impacted than, say, your financial vertical, just because of the cost of the device themselves. Mm. So you do see some clustering around either price points or industry or vertical or region when you look at these scan results. And so we're doing a lot more work right now on the back end to help identify trends that are specific to particular industry. So, for example, in finance, we can say the top X vulnerabilities of finance are A, B, and C. That's where we want to get to, but it's a lot of work to get there, and we've got a pretty small team. So
it is, and you know, Rapid7's leading the campaign at the moment to sort of try to restore some sanity to the CFAA. And I think I saw your name actually pop up in the press in the last couple of months, just saying that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act makes a lot of this type of research quite legally risky. Do you hold to that? Do you maintain that this is riskier given the CFAA?
The kind of ironic thing was, Ornheimer's vacation, basically. We was eventually let out of jail, but basically on a technicality of jurisdiction. And he's, you know, vowed to fight it and so on and so on. But one thing that was interesting that actually hurt the case for CFA in the opinion of the vacation was saying that if you bypass a tactical measure or you get access to personal identifiable information, even if it's just one byte, even if you immediately throw it away, even if you never look at it, you technically violate the law. So the CFAA prosecutes activity, not impact. And that's been the biggest problem because the activity is unauthorized access, which is about as vague as it can be. Essentially, anybody who's doing security research in the U.S. operates basically under the auspices of prosecutorial discretion. If someone wants to go after you, they can make a case and some prosecutor thinks they can nail you some way, they could probably get away with it. Fortunately, Rapid7 has been great about having my back. We have a criminal defense attorney I can call whenever an issue comes up. And I spend quite a lot of time talking to law enforcement and helping them educate their friends and their coworkers about what the stuff means, why the law is broken, what needs to be fixed. So there's a lot you can do just by, you know, educating the right people within law enforcement and helping, public policy campaigns and so on. We're pretty heavily involved in some reform actions on the CFA side.
How much do you worry about being, I think the words you use, blackbagged?
I mean, the thing is, for the last 10 years, I basically have had to worry about it. The way, longer than that now, like 12, 13 years, ever since I started working at Metasploit, basically I've been in a position where the tools that I write, the tools that I give away, could be used to in the involvement of a crime, and I could somehow be linked into it. So that was one of the reasons why my original employer, when I started working on it, decided to stay far away from it as far as they could. It took a really long time for the public to really accept that these tools really are, the black hats don't need this stuff. The black hats don't need Metasploit. They already have all the tools they want. They're doing a great job of owning the internet without us. What we're trying to do is put the defenders in the same footing, let the defenders test their systems before they get hacked by somebody else. To some degree, we're in the same position right now with internet-wide scanning as we were with pen testing tools, with vulnerability assessments, in that we're starting to see greater public acceptance of the methods, of the techniques. You've got less people that try to prosecute you just for port scanning the server. We do our best to help notify people of vulnerabilities when we find them, but that notification process is honestly the toughest part of all of this, is doing the outreach, is identifying the owners of affected assets. So that's what a lot of our challenges are this year, is not just, okay, we know what all the big numbers are, we know how to exploit X million machines, but how do we actually get the ISPs to get off their butts and fix it? That's been
good
our
luck
biggest
with
challenge.
That.
Well, one way you can do it is publicly shaming them, saying, hey, ISP in Germany, 6 million of your customers can have their phone bills, rang up to a couple $1,000 a piece through SIP, which actually happened a few years ago. Mm. There are cases out there that would put some fear into these ISPs, and then would in turn pressure their suppliers, manufacturers, into building better, more secure hardware. But we're a long way away. I mean, we're going to be exploiting embedded devices en masse for the next 10 years plus. IPv6, like you said, makes it much harder to discover these devices. But once you know where they are, or if you're able to see logs from a map, from traffic, or run a website where someone visits it, or there's some other tricks you can use, obviously. This stuff becomes, it doesn't really improve the security. It just makes it harder to identify and secure it.
Indeed. All right, the presentation is called Internet Scanning, Current State and Lessons Learned. It occurs on August 6th at Black Hat USA, and it will be presented by Mark Schlosser of Rapid7 Labs. HD, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking some time out to chat to us, and hopefully we'll have you on the show again soon.
Oh, thanks, Pat. Anytime.
HD Moore there on behalf of Rapid7, this week's sponsor. Big thanks to them again. And that is it for this week's show. Here in Australia, it is already July 4, which is, of course, America's National Independence Day. So a heartfelt happy July 4th to all of our American listeners. You do have an amazing country, inspiring yet simultaneously, I kind of think of America as being the best and worst of everything. It exports amazing art, technology, music, thought, culture. And then the whole place explodes in rage when McDonald's workers want $7 an hour. And, seriously, as the Yanks themselves would say, what gives? But I guess it is what it is. What better way to mark the 4th of July than with a little slice of America's very own 1960s counterculture in this week's feature track. You're about to hear an excerpt from Jimi Hendrix's 1968 masterpiece, 1983 A Merman I Should Turn to Be. It's about an imagined dystopian future in which he despairs of humanity and returns to the ocean, where life began. It was recorded in 1968 and featured on the album Electric Ladyland. Hendrix played all of the guitar, bass and percussion on this track. Mitch Mitchell plays drums and Chris Wood plays flute. It is a beautiful, beautiful song. It's some of his best work. The original track runs for approximately 13 minutes, so I've just taken an excerpt, which is the main part of the song, for everyone to have a listen to. I really hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Rita and me desire to take our last walk through the noise to the sea. Not to die, but to be reborn away from a land so battered and torn. Say, can you see it's really such a mess? Every inch of earth is a fighting mess. Giant prince. pencil and a lipstick tube shaped flames continue to rain and cause screaming pain and the Arctic stains from silver blue to bloody red as our feet find the sand and the sea. Is straight ahead. That's what they say. That's why they coming with this thing. And they also said it's impossible for a man to live and breathe underwater. Forever was a main complaint. And they also threw this in my face. They said, anyway, you know good and well, it would be beyond the will of God and the grace of the king. My darling and I make love in the sand to salute the last moment ever on dry land. Our machine and its dentist work played its part well. Without a scratch on our body, I may bid it farewell. Starfish and giant phones greet us with a smile. Before our heads go under, we take a last look at killing noise.
Warp the outer style.